You're listening to Stand Out with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Stand Out with myself, Ian O'Connell, is crime journalist and best-selling author Paul Williams. Paul is one of Ireland's most respected journalists, known for his fearless investigative reporting on organised crime and covering high-profile cases. Paul lived with 24-hour full-time police protection for several years, given the nature of his job, and after the 1996 murder of Veronica Guerin, Paul took over from her as crime correspondent of the Sunday World. Sit back and enjoy the show. Paul, I'm delighted to have you on the show. I've been an admirer of your work for a good while, and I appreciate you coming on. How's life with you?
It's very good, Ian. And how's everybody down in the Kerry, the kingdom of Kerry?
We're all good down here. You know, when the things are going well, especially when the football is going good in our favour, we're all happy campers down here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, that's good. Well, you still have the Healy Rays in top form, so Kerry won't sink anytime soon.
No, we'll stay above float for a while anyway.
Okay.
I like to ask my guest to start, Paul. I know that that obviously living in Dublin now, but originally you're not from Dublin. Do you want to just tell me a bit about growing up? Were you always kind of interested in crime and that side of things?
Well, I'm from a place called Ballinamore in County Leitrim. Which is the most wonderful part of the country, much nicer than Kerry by, and also perhaps the greatest undiscovered jewel in the Irish landscape. That's my Leitrim Tourism Board plug finished. So where I grew up was close to the border. The nearest thing to crime I would have seen growing up was the activities of the Provisional IRA, and we didn't see much of that, even though there was a lot of IRA terrorist activity where we were growing up, you know, a lot of Garda and Army presence. So there was very little crime apart from that, and it didn't impinge on our lives very much. How did I develop an interest in crime? I went to college. My story to education is a little bit sort of convoluted, because I was in three secondary schools in 5 years, principally due to the fact that I was a bit of a gouger myself, and I was getting in trouble and was expelled from a few of them. But I ended up in a school at Tech in Carrigallen, and 10 miles from my home, where my family are originally from. And I developed a great interest in journalism, and I really, really wanted to be a journalist. And so I got into college, and then when I came out after first year. It was a 2-year course at the time, the only journalism school in Ireland. And
it's Rathmines, Paul, was it?
That's right, yeah, Rathmines, where just like my classmate would have been another Kerry man, Stephen Ray.
Yeah.
There was another Kerry man, Ger McCarty. There was another Kerry man, Ger Ryle. All fellas who have made their names in journalism since, quite well. Like Ger Ryle is in the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in Australia. Stephen Ray became the editor-in-chief of the entire independent group. Now he's left from there now. I came out and I started work experience with the Longford News, and then the Leitrim Observer, my local newspaper, called me and said, would you come and work for us? And my course supervisor at the time, Dave Rice, who's still a very dear friend of mine, in his 90s, and he's younger now and more, he has greater mental clarity now than he had 50 years ago. He's as mentally sharp as he always was. He said to me, take the job, because this is 1984 at this stage, and we were under the cosh of the Catholic Church. We were economically screwed. Everybody I grew up with, particularly in places like Leitrim, had left the country. They were either in America or they were in London or in the UK. So I was told, take the job. So I took the job in the Leitrim Observer. And one of the jobs I started covering in the Leitrim Observer was crime, because this new phenomenon, and I wrote about this in my book, Crooks. Literally, it was the start of this new phenomenon called rural crime. Now, again, Ian, back in 1984, the vast majority of your listeners probably weren't even born at the time, but back in 1984, Yes, we had really sort of serious problems with terrorism and subversion and the troubles. And there was a growing number of criminals in operation, but nothing like today. But rural crime still literally was the place, or rural Ireland was literally the place where you could walk out and leave the key in your door. And in my home territory of Leitrim, particularly, and I literally started getting interested in it. All these robberies started happening, but they were mostly elderly people, very people like my grandmother. You know, she wasn't robbed, but she had died some years before. But I had great respect for the elderly. And this was, it's hard to explain now, but at the time, as a young reporter, but also for the community that you were serving, it was seen as absolutely shocking that these thugs would come out of the night, particularly and target the weakest and most vulnerable people in society. So I started, I suppose that's where my journey to crime started, covering these stories and sitting down with these people. And over a number of months, people who were victims of this crime. And I remember it was the time that, you know, one of the reasons which goes to show, shows that it failed, or the misguided life I had, that I'm well known for people trying to kill me. But the first time I was nearly shot was outside my hometown of Ballinamore on the side of Slieveannairn Mountain, the Mountain of Iron, where this elderly man who had fought in the Troubles, the original Troubles in the War of Independence, he had dispatched these would-be robbers when they came to his house with his old shotgun. He was in his 70s. John Bernard Keeney was his name. So I arrived at his house one afternoon with a photographer from the Leitrim Observer to interview him, because this is a heroic story. And it was just a basic cottage, you know, with a little front door. And you know, there was kind of little, you see them all over rural Ireland from a different age. They have a little sort of a thing built around the front of the door, you know, like it's not like a porch, but it's a sort of like, it takes the mean look at the front of the house. It's like a rectangular structure just around the house, around the front door that comes out from, you know, around it, to give a bit of shelter when people are standing at the door or whatever. So I was standing in this, knocked the door. This lovely old lady, his wife, stood at the door, said, "Hello, son, how are you?" Now, at the time, I had a big mullet on me. I was wearing combat jackets, a combat jacket, all worn jeans. I looked like probably one of the fellows who come out of the dark to rob you. And I said, "Is John Bernard in, Mrs.?" And she said, "He is." And then in a moment, she disappeared. And all I could see in front of me was the two shiny barrels of this very old shotgun. I was in the FCA for 20 years, so I know weapons. And all I could see was the two shiny barrels. First thing went into my head was, geez, that gun is very well maintained. And down the end of it, I could see two old hammers, a real old hammer. It was one of those really old shotguns. And I said to myself, "Oh my God, they could slip very quickly. And next thing, I'm going to be blown away." Now, I had to put my hands up instinctively. And the man said to me, he said, "I shot black and tans with this gun, and I shoot a dirty gippo like you." So I goes, "Oh Jesus." And I put my hands up. And in my best Leitrim accent, I said, no. And I knew I couldn't go forward, but I also couldn't go back because I was in this, you know, this area I described outside the front door, this kind of porch effect. For me to go back, it would have been two or three steps to get out of the range of the gun. And I could see his steely blue eye looking down the barrel at me. And I remember saying to Joe, no. He said, I'm from Ballinamore. My name is Paul Williams. I'm from Ballinamore, from the Leitrim Observer. I'm just down there, and there's no chip post there. Or something like that. And anyway, I talked him down, and in a few minutes we were sitting around drinking cups of tea and having chunks of lovely cake that his wife had made. But it was one of those really heartwarming stories where he had taken the gun and he told me he would shoot them. If you're a criminal, you are now to be wrapped up in cotton wool. At the time, I did research and all of this again, went back on all of this stuff again when I was doing this book Crooks 2 years ago. And the interesting thing is the comments from the local superintendent at the time. And his comment was, he wasn't saying, like, if that happened today, the first thing the guards would do, Ian, is they go up to the likes of John Bernard Keeney and take the gun off him. So that when the criminals came back the next time, they could kill him if they wanted. And I'm really, really passionate about that. And I've always been very passionate about that. But at that time, the superintendent was making it perfectly known. He said, if these guys keep going around, rambling around to these houses where people have guns, they'll end up getting shot. But to bring the story on, a bit, because it's sort of fresh in my mind, around 2015, I went to Dublin. I got involved in writing crime full time and did my thing. And but around 2015, I got involved in a very major campaign highlighting the problem of rural crime again. And the thing about rural crime was it was always close to my heart. And why is it close to my heart? It is because my heart is close to rural Ireland and always has been. And I still see those terrified elderly people looking at me when I went to their homes to interview them. And the shock, it was the shock and disillusionment in their faces that used to, that had the biggest resonance, because it was the shock that these were people in their 70s and 80s in 1984. They'd seen a completely different world. And now they were seeing this new, like it was like for them, the world had completely gone mad. For them, it was suddenly they couldn't recognize the world that they lived in, that they were everything that they stood for all their lives had suddenly been turned upside down. And that's why I got very heavily involved in that campaign and still do. And I worked with different community groups around the country who wanted to highlight rural crime. And we started this campaign, and in 2015, it became huge because we it culminated in a meeting in the Anna Hotel in Turles, and with this group of people I was working with. And I think we had 2 or 3,000 people came to that meeting. And then we had another monstrous meeting up in Kells, or in Trim, in County Meath. And it really, really woke the country up. It certainly woke the government up to the fact that rural Ireland wasn't being policed right. But that's an elongated way of saying how I got involved in writing about crime first. But I think I just tried to explain how why that particular type of crime, well, all crime, I'm passionate about in that. And I've met so many, many victims, and but colleagues of mine being murdered and everything. But that particular kind of crime, that's the first crime I witnessed as a journalist and chronicled. And it's something that has, never left me either. So I got involved in that. Then I after 6 months with the Leitrim Observer, I was offered a full-time job in the Longford News in Longford. So I went back to Longford for 2 years, and then I got a job that was advertised in the Sunday World. And myself and another little-known journalist and now international best-selling author called Cathy Kelly, my dear friend, her and I joined the Sunday World together. And she's famous for writing books that actually make money and actually make millions of euro around the world, as I always say to her.
And like you mentioned there, Paul, no, that's a great way just to give a flavour to the listeners, how you did get involved in it, something you're still passionate about, that type of crime as well. I suppose being at this time of the year, and I know you're on Ireland Lame recently, Veronica Guerin, you mentioned there are some colleagues and names. Obviously that was a pivotal time in Irish crime, and I suppose it was known worldwide
Irish
then.
society, yeah. I mean, Irish
Yeah.
society, and
In
it was a
society
fairly
in
pivotal
general.
point. It was a pivotal point in my life. My life changed that day.
Do you remember where you are that day,
Oh,
Paul?
yeah. Oh my God, I do, yeah. Like we had to do for Veronica there on the 26th, and the week, the build up to it. I was in the Sunday World newsroom at. Veronica was murdered at 1:54, or sorry, 12:54 p.m., 6 minutes to one. And I was in the Sunday World newsroom, and I was planning a job. I was going to go to Liverpool on some gig that was on. Some Tuareg was up for Derek Maradona Dunn was up on trial for possession of heroin, a League of Ireland footballer. Anyway. And I got a call from one of my Garda friends who became a Garda friend through the fact that for the previous 2 or 3 years, he and his colleagues had been minding myself and my wife and my family. And he said, basically, they're after coming after Veronica again. And I goes, yeah. And he says, what? I said, and he says, they've shot her. And I goes, go away. That's not true. I was so shocked. And he said, no. He said, she's dead. And then he said, And I said, "No, that can't be right. That can't be right. That's nonsense." And he said, "No, I'm standing beside the car. I'm looking at her. Don't come up here." And he told me exactly where he was in the Nace Road and the old Boot Road corner. And of course, I was up there. I went up there. It wasn't far, a long distance. So I went up there. I was up there because I was known no more than Veronica for being fond of driving fast. I got up there in less than 10 minutes. And when I arrived there, what I do recall was the silence. And Veronica's car was there, the red, distinctive red Calibra. Most of the other cars that had been on the Nace Road had gone. There were squad cars all around. And the guards who came walking towards me were ashen faced. That all those things just stuck out in my mind. They were clearly in shock. Now, guards arriving at scenes for somebody's been shot, they're very used to it, but or killed. But because they saw the enormity of this straight away, they were the first people there, and I just instinctively walked straight over to the car, and nobody stopped me. Nobody said boo, nobody said anything, and there she was in the car. And the one thing struck me first was she was wearing the same suit that she'd worn a couple of months earlier when the two of us were on the Brian Farrell had this political program on a Sunday evening, and the two of us were on talking about crime, and out in RTE, and I could see she was still in the safety belt. I described it 100 times last week and the weeks leading up, and I've done it hundreds of times in the past 30 years, but it still always gets me. It always catches me. And it was the midsection of her body was all black from, and that was from blood, because it was a dark suit she was wearing, but it was there, and that's where they shot her, in the middle of the body. And then the rest is all a blur. I just started to cry. I started to throw up. I collapsed. I was in a complete mess. In fact, there's a picture that was taken of me at the time. It surfaced again. Actually, we ran it in the book, or one of the books, where I was just in a heap sitting on the side of the road, because it's hard to explain. She was a friend. She was a competitor. This was my world and her world. There was only two of us in that world, by the way, at the time. There were no other crime reporters like us around at the time. Now that's different now. There's crime reporters everywhere now, because it was as a result of Veronica's murder that crime reporting became a big thing in Irish media. So this was my life that I had chosen. This was her life. There was only two of us at it, and now she's dead. And I instinctively knew straight away who did it. And I turned around and I said, "Gilligan did this to the guard." And when I was crying, I said, "We know who did this, because John Traynor, who was one of the people to set her up, who was one of her sources and also a source of mine, a notorious criminal. And he was the partner in crime with John Gilligan." He told me in January 1995, just for people if they haven't missed this, January 1995, the gang shot Veronica in the leg at her home. John Traynor is the man suspected of organizing that, even though he was her source. And then Gilligan beat her up savagely in September of 1995, when she went to his house to ask him the question that the state wouldn't: "Where did you get your millions from, John?" And she told me after that, she said that was more terrifying than being shot. But after that, Traynor met me and looked me straight in the eye, and he said, "Gilligan will kill Veronica." And he said, "He will kill you as well." He said he will kill anyone who interferes with his family or his business. I'm telling you. And Traynor was terrified of him. So I'm standing at Veronica's car listening to his voice in my head. And we knew from that moment on who it was. Everybody knew. And okay, the guards did a spectacular job. Another brilliant, brilliant Kerry man called Tony Hickey took over the investigation. One of the finest men, and if I was asked to nominate a number of heroes, well, Tony be right up there. So that was that day, yeah. And then, as I said, the world changed. It was hugely emotional. And then 4 years later, Martin O'Hagan, another friend of mine, he worked with us in the Sunday World, in the Northern office of the Sunday World, he was shot dead. And Marty used to come and stay with me in times when he was under serious threat in the north, he'd have to leave. And I always said, "Look, Marty, there's always a bed for you here." So there were two friends, two colleagues murdered in the space of less than 5 years. It was horrendous. And as I said to somebody, that was when, for me, to use the old gangland or mafia adage, it was no longer business for me. It was then personal. I suppose the rest is history. I survived. I'm okay. There was no problem. But the stuff that happened that time, like it really, and that's why for the past few weeks, to tell you the truth, Ian, this has been very, 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 very raw. And then on Friday night, last Friday night, when Jimmy Gearn and Veronica's brother, I became a very, very close friend of the family. And Mrs. Gearn, Bernie, Veronica's mum, she adopted me as another one of her sons. And I loved that lady. And I think she loved me. And we were very, very close. And but on Friday night, when I was, Jimmy organized this huge gala commemoration. It was about 500, 600 people in the in the National Convention Centre in Dublin. And towards, at one stage there was a speech being made, and I was having a few glasses sitting beside my colleague Paul Reynolds and my dear friend Joe Duffy and our wives. And because Jimmy had invited me from the very beginning, and he was asking me advice on how he was organized, and he did a brilliant job, and he raised over 130,000 euro for the hospice in Raheny in Dublin. But anyway, they announced, the editor-in-chief of the Irish Independent announced that, well, they wanted to single out a journalist. And the rest is a blur to me then, because they presented me with this award, which was like, I went up on stage, and just like the day that when Veronica was murdered, I was lost for words, which never happened to me in my life, Ian, before. I'm a big mouth, I'm a motor mouth, but and I, as you realize, I can't shut up when I start. But I got up on stage and I opened this, and there was it was a beautiful glass. What do you call it? I don't know what you call it, a statue almost. And there was a picture of my face and Veronica's together. And when I saw that, I was just completely overwhelmed with emotion. And I couldn't speak. And I started to cry like a big baby. This was all genuinely from the heart. But it was also a great honor. It was one of the greatest honor. It took me days to sort of process it all, but it was a sort of a strange end to a 30-year journey, if you want to put it that way, you know.
And like you said, Paul, kind of journalism, crime journalism, when that happened, kind of took off. But did you? I know there was a few pivotal points in Irish history, specifically, obviously the Veronica Guerin and then the Regency. But after Veronica Guerin, did policing change in Ireland?
Well, it certainly did, because our history has been that, we in the build up to Veronica's murder, the state had been completely preoccupied with the threat posed by the Provisional IRA to usurp and undermine the state. And so policing wasn't paying the attention it should have been paying to the growing phenomenon of organized crime, which at this stage now was over 20 years old. Now, at this stage, by the time Veronica was murdered, I'd produced my first book, was called The General, and that was the first real book about organized crime in Ireland. And that sort of started giving us, a picture, a window on to this growing world of organized crime. But I do remember that at the time that the narrative from Senior Gardaí at the time was that there's no such thing as organized crime and there's no such thing as millionaire criminals. And we were hearing all the time about this guy, John Gilligan, and I knew about Gilligan. I covered Gilligan's trial in 1990 when he was put away for armed robberies and burglaries, because I was aware of how I'd started working in the Sunday World in 1987, and I started doing crime when I went in there, because I was interested in it. But it was very new territory. But so Gilligan, is building this massive equestrian center, and that ultimately the state was doing nothing about it. And Veronica went and asked the question, where'd you get the money? So basically, like all violence in gangland, it's always about the money. It's always about the money. In fact, everything in life seems to be about the money. And in gangland, the only way you acquire money, keep it, and if anyone messes around with you or you have a boardroom dispute, you kill. And John Gillingham was a particularly violent and nasty, vile thug. But so Veronica is murdered because of the money. And that actually, as I said in a piece I wrote in the Irish Independent last week, the public, we've never seen the best way to describe it in terms of a murder, the reaction of the Irish people to the murder of Veronica Guerin, coming 19 days, by the way, after the murder of another good Kerryman, a great Kerryman, Gerry McCabe, by the IRA. At the IRA, and then they tried to kill, they tried to murder his partner, Ben O'Sullivan, was critically injured. So 19 days later, gangsters come and murder Veronica. Those two murders were committed largely because of money, because the IRA wanted money. And the gangsters wanted to save their money because at that time John Gillingham was going to go to prison for assaulting Veronica, and he would have lost, he and his gang were going to lose up to £300,000 per week when he was away, and he would have easily got a 12 months. And the only way to put him away at that stage was because of the assault that he did that he committed against Veronica in September 1995, and he had been in court with her the day before, and he told some guard prophetically, "I won't. This is never going to go ahead." And so the state then, all the parties in the Dáil united, the public united, the media, the Gardaí, all the arms of the state worked together. Everybody worked together. Even criminals started coming forward to the police. They even started talking to people like me because they wanted not, did not want in any way to be associated with this atrocity. And I say that we have never seen a reaction to a murder like that before or since. In our society, we never saw Ireland so galvanized and united either before or since. Probably not since, and no murder, not since perhaps the murder or the killing or assassination of Michael Collins back at the foundation of the state, has a murder really affected people. And as I described in the piece I wrote in the Indo, it was our finest hour. And as a result of that, we produced this raft of legislation that basically gave rise and birth to an organization called the Criminal Assets Bureau. And the Criminal Assets Bureau very quickly became perhaps one of the most successful law enforcement agencies in the world, and still is. And this, the sad thing is, and Bernie, Veronica's mother, always said this was her girl's legacy. And it is her legacy. And then, of course, go on then the that legislation was so important in taking on organized crime ever since. But then on top of that, the other most important legislation that was ever introduced was also introduced on the back of an atrocity. And that was the murder of Roy Collins in Limerick in 2009, who again, he, his dad and his family are very, very close friends of mine. A lot of my friends, people I would call close family friends, have been the victims of gangland crime through the years. And Roy was murdered, and just before that, Shane Gagan, an innocent poor guy who was a rugby player, was shot by mistake by the McCarthy Dundons as well. And those two murders enforced the state to bring in what was called the most draconian legislation of its time since Veronica's legislation, which is the cab. And that was they made it a criminal offence to be a member of an organised crime gang. Brilliant legislation. They made it a criminal offence to be the leader of an organised crime gang. They made it so that anyone charged with organised criminal activity or related offences were all to be charged in the non-jury special criminal court. Brilliant, brilliant move. And particularly, the Gardaí were allowed then to plant bugs and surveillance equipment on the homes, cars, and properties, or anywhere that criminals were congregating, where they were capable of compiling evidence against them and then using that evidence in the courts. And I make the point that all that legislation, the most effective legislation in the war against organized crime in this country, all of it came about there because of their acts. We got the legislation that we needed to take them on. And I always make the point as well, coming again, talking for too long, is that, for example, if it hadn't been I don't believe for a minute that any of that legislation would ever have been enacted, by the way, at all, if there hadn't been for the pivotal events that compelled the government to act. They would not, the Criminal Assets Bureau, if they ever set it up a way and Veronica was never murdered, would have been limp wristed. It would have been absolutely useless. So, you know, as a result of all of that, all of that legislation is the reason why the prisons are full of members of the Kinahan organization, Murder Incorporated from Limerick, as in the McCarthy Dundons, and scores and hundreds of other criminals. And I would dread to think what kind of society we'd have if we didn't have that legislation. That's one of the lessons I've learned through being in this job for all these years. When you can look back and put it in that kind of context, my God, it always took the death and the needless murder of heroes to make us wake up, sniff the coffee. Because, I'm as well, I get this off my chest. Whenever I hear people moaning and whinging and cherry picking whose death and whose crime they're going to get upset over, some people in the real hard left, I never heard any of them be moaning or how's the term I'm to use the word I'm trying to use, remembering the sacrifice of Veronica Guerin, for example. You never hear them mentioning it because it doesn't suit their agenda. Because a lot of them are after the criminal votes, from what I can see. But I mean, that's me just letting a bit of steam off my chest, Ian. Please forgive me. Let's continue.
No, but it all does go back to that and the legacy that she has left. Paul, I would say we were talking there before we came on about your book, The Crooks, the two of them, and it kind of brings the readers behind the scenes. You kind of pull back the curtain to some of the experiences you had, and I suppose some of the background of the cases you have covered. Do you think that was always important that you are going to pull back that curtain and kind of let the readers in more?
Well, I don't know. I've written 14 books now in total. So, I did that because my publisher said it to me one day. I said, "Well, why wouldn't you write a story about your own?" Because every time I'd sit down with them from London, and whenever I would sit down, I'd start telling them yarns, stories. You know, I'm going to tell you about this. She said, "Why don't you write about it?" Because they were saying, you know, I wrote the book on the monk, which was a huge seller, the biggest selling crime book for the past 10 years, I'm told. Then I wrote a book the following year in 20, and then I did The Monk in 20, and then a new version of it in 23, and in 21 I did a book on Gilligan. So they were saying, you know, why did you think about it? So I sat down and I started writing, and I wrote the stories about what it was like growing up, you know, and I talked a lot about the rural crime thing, which is, as I say, a big part of my life. I talk about the general, the personalized stories of how we went after the criminals, how we built up intelligence on them, what happened when we encountered them, you know, when the death threat started. I went into a lot of that, because I found all these files. I have a very big office here, and well, it's an office stuffed with documents, but I found a huge amount of documentation that I'd got through the years of reports of. Like the police would quietly give them to you, you know, reports of activity or people coming to try and shoot me and stuff like that. And I compiled all of that. And it's only when you put it down on paper, you say, my God, how crazy all of that was. The things that went on. You know, so many dead people that I traveled in the shoes of through the years. And because I suppose what I was able to do is that I was a front seat passenger, a chronicler of the history, a big part of Ireland's social history. And it was a white knuckle ride, as I describe in the book. And it's only when you put it in perspective like this, you know, in a way, it was a pleasure and it was an honor to have been around to record that as 20, 30, over 30 years of. 40 years of history of Irish history that you were there, because people, you know, there's a line said something, you know, if journalism is the first rough draft of history, then crime journalism tends to be rougher than most. And that was a quote from a guy called Duncan Campbell, who was an outstanding crime journalist over in the UK, true crime journalist, who I read quite a lot about of during the years. So yeah, that was what the book was about, and it was quite emotional as well, because there's a lot of ghosts that were, shall we say, disturbed from their resting places. Just so many, one of the things is just my editor in the publishing house said, Jesus, so many dead bodies, so many dead people,
And like one thing you did speak about and you kind of touched on a minute ago was the few years you had with the police protection at home and stuff. And when you did go into this, did you find out the deaths of the journalists? And when you did get the kind of police protection, that obviously changed your whole, not just you, but like the family kind of life and routine at home, did it?
Yeah, but that it started spiraling in, like we said, no journalist ever be killed again in 1996. Then Marty is murdered, but that's the North. So that's a different place, if you know what I mean. And we all look at that. We have a repartitionist mindset in the South, and perhaps quite justifiably so, because they do things differently in the North. And there's different parameters for behavior, but it started to escalate, and things got really, really serious in 2003. In fact, in 2003, I described that in the book, in the first Crooks book, as being, literally the police, National Bureau of Criminal Investigation. There was a team were coming to me practically every week to tell me what the latest plot was against me.
You said in the book that the only death threats you kind of took serious were the ones from the police.
Oh, absolutely. Because, like, if somebody threatens you, picks up the phone and rings you and says, Ian O'Connell, I'm going to shoot you. Nine times out of ten, 99.9% of the time, that's all bullshit. That's some asshole just fenting off. But you do have to follow it up, because they just give them a slap in the face, don't be doing that again. Yeah, they were the most serious, because they were coming from intelligence sources, which meant that the people who were planning these acts didn't want anyone to know they were planning them. And they're the worst ones. The same way they murdered Veronica, And they murdered Marty. They all kept it very, very quiet, and nobody picked up a whisper about it. Because normally, if it was talked about in the underworld, somebody had tipped the police off. So it was getting very, very serious. There were two or three very serious threats against my life. It culminated with a bomb scare at the house, and 2 weeks beforehand, or 3 weeks beforehand, an acid attack on my car at the house. Then a bomb, a very elaborate hoax bomb. That's so elaborate that the bomb squad ordered the Garda Síochána to clear out the entire cul-de-sac where I lived at 3 o'clock on a November morning. It was just horrible. Like, that's how intimidation works at its best. They were making my life unlivable, because my neighbors were experiencing so much discomfort and fear as a result of what I was doing. Anyway, that resulted, the police started looking at it and said they realized that was carried out by a fellow called Martin Foley, the Viper. And in fairness, the Viper probably saved my life, because there was a much more serious effort being made by others. They, like a hitman was came to have a look at me, so he would be able to identify me when he met me in the place he wanted to kill me. And he didn't want to make a mistake, which was something I appreciated, that professionalism of him. But the guards came to me after the bomb scare and said, look, this is much more serious than just a fake bomb. This is, they're going to kill you. And Jerry, Christy Kinahan's people, Christy Kinahan advised these guys how to get rid of me. There was a group around a fella called Sean Dunn out in North Dublin. There was link people with links to the Provisional IRA involved in this plot, and the INLA. People who hated my guts, the INLA particularly had an awful trouble with me. And they were going to, there was, in that year, there was about three live threats together. And so the guard said to me, I remember this chief superintendent sitting down with me, because I took my wife and kids away. We went to the K Club, actually, which was very nice. If you want to go on the run, go to the K Club.
That's it.
And so I
Over
said,
around the golf.
no, I don't play golf. I went clay pigeon shooting, because I was hoping that the lads might let me hang on to the gun. And but it was a friend of mine was in charge of security down there, and the guards came to see me and said, right, when you come back, we're putting two full-time armed detectives, which are from Special Branch, 24/7, 365. And then they said, we're going to put a uniformed guards during the day from 8 in the morning till 6 or 7 in the evening, I think it was. There will be uniform guards at your home, and from then to the following morning, it will then be armed Gardaí at your home. And they say, your man said to me, now he said, you know what happened for Anarchy Gearn. And I said, clearly. And he said, well, the same thing is going to happen to you, but we're not going to be found wanting. We tried to protect Veronica. She didn't take the protection. We're telling you, you need to take this protection. We have decided that this protection is to be placed on you. And if you don't want it, which we highly advise you against, he said, we will, you will have to sign documents to say you don't want the protection. Because then it's not our fault. It'll be your fault if you get killed. So, like, what are you going to do in a conference? As Billy Connolly said, there's a bit of a conversation stopper. We had to, after that, I did accept it. And the police lived with us. They lived with us full time for over 10 years. And in that period of time, we moved from one house to the other, bought a new house. And within that 10-year period, for over 2.5 years, I had 2 full-time armed bodyguards with me wherever I went. And it was quite a strange experience. But one, as an aside, actually, when we went to buy our dream house, by the way, which we moved to live in Rathfarnham, I was sent back the cheque. I went to buy the house in 2004, about a year after the protection had started. And people got panicked when they realized it was me was moving in. And literally, they sent me back the cheque, the builders, and said, basically, the people don't want to live beside you. And I made the point, you know, guys, I'm doing my job. I'm not the bad guy. And that's an example of how intimidation skews logic in society. Do you know what I mean? Like, people were thinking, we don't want him living beside us. And for a while we were lawyering up to fight this tooth and nail. Because, like, if I was a member of an ethnic minority, or a different gender identification, you could not do that to me. No, you would not. That would be called discrimination. Everybody saw sense in the end. I got the house. However, then, and I remember this really well, I went one morning after the builders agreed to sell to me. I was borrowing 1 million euro, crazy money, a Celtic Tiger nonsense. And I had to get life insurance. And they knew I wouldn't get life insurance. But this, ironically, this morning, I went for a breakfast meeting, a breakfast talk for the insurance industry, the Irish insurance industry, all love me. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, every one of those companies that came to applaud Paul Williams in Dublin Castle talking about organized crime had said, is that Paul Williams, the journalist you're looking for the insurance for? No. Every one of them had turned me down for insurance. And all of this as a consequence. Now, in the end, we sorted it out. I had discovered I had bits and pieces. It was the 1 million euro that freaked them all out. They said, there's no way we're going to insure him for 1 million. It's very likely his wife would be collecting it, you know. And so anyway, we sorted it out. We got different. We ended up going to Lloyd's in London, and we got different life insurance. And that's why I was encouraged to write that book to explain the kind of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that nobody ever heard about before. And it's I like to think as well that intimidation brings out the coward in people, and I despise cowardice almost as much as I despise bullies. Does that make sense to you, or am I just
No,
mad?
it does 100%. And like you say, you don't stand down from these people. Do you think that the likes of fearless investigative reporting is becoming kind of a not a dying art in Ireland, but do you think that it's not as maybe fearless as before?
Well, you see, we were in uncharted waters, right? So when people say use the term unprecedented, that means that this has never happened before. But we've had plenty of precedent set now when it comes to atrocity and stuff like that. Journalists, especially crime journalists, still have to be very careful what to do, where to go, because you'll always find some lunatic somewhere. But, like, you know, you see Gerry Hutch cozying up to the media now and, getting to tell his story, you know. That sends out a message to other villains. Well, the journalists aren't that bad, unless, like, he picks out people he doesn't like, people like me. But he would never, like, in fairness to Gerry Hutch, the monk, never posed a threat to me or any other journalist, because, in fairness to him, He's the, as I always said, the least worst of all of them.
Is he a bit
He doesn't like what's written
misunderstood,
about
Bond?
him.
Is Jory Hutch a bit misunderstood?
Oh no, that he's a gangster in the
Yeah.
story, and he's trying to make himself respectable. That's a different story. That's going beyond the boundaries. You know, that'd be like turning around and saying, "Listen, Jerry, now cop yourself on some. You're losing the run yourself here. You need to remember where the parameters are." But I know, for example, that Hutch, I credit Hutch with saving my bacon on a number of occasions, because I believe that the some of the more sensitive information about the plots to kill me in 2003 came from Jerry Hutch's side. And I actually wrote that in one of the books and said, if he did it, I thank him. It was the only way I could send the message to him, you know. But I tell you what I wouldn't be doing. I wouldn't be giving him a soft interview about telling us how lovely a guy he is, because I know where the body ball, the where the bodies are buried. And I tell you who another person is, Paul Reynolds. Paul Reynolds is an outstanding crime journalist in RTE. And Paul Reynolds, you see the way he reacted to Paul Reynolds after the election in 2024? You know, that was an example of, like, he knew Paul Reynolds was going to ask the questions he didn't want to answer, and actually decided he wasn't going to answer. But and the way he got so angry at him. And I went to see that play that Rex Ryan, and Rex Ryan is the son of Jerry Ryan, and Jerry Ryan was a close friend of mine. And young Rex, he always calls me Uncle Paulie. But I was really annoyed with Rex. I said he allowed Jerry Hutch to he did the play The Monk, and he allowed Jerry Hutch to dominate the whole thing. And to more or less hijack it as a political stunt, that play he did in Dublin. And I was annoyed with, very annoyed at Rex about it. And I wrote that about it, you know, as again, and I remember going to the play that night, and a friend of mine who was a hardy dude, now he's a real dub, and this fella is about, I always say he's like an army ranger. He's about 5 foot 5. He makes me look tall because the atmosphere was so intimidating and so hostile. Because, as I said, in a more eloquent way, I said in this piece I wrote in the Indo about it, that the people who were there would not be your typical theatre-going audience. In other words, there were gougers and people, criminals and people like that, who just were there, you know, to you know, well, cheer on their man Jerry, you know what I mean, as the way they would say it. And I think that's a sort of a parameter. That's a boundary that shouldn't be breached. You can't start. That's glamorizing these guys, and it doesn't work, and it's bad for society. You know, Jerry Hutch, all the evidence is there. Read my book, The Monk. There's a plug from your own book. Read my book, The Monk, and make up your own mind about what he is and what he did and what he didn't do.
Paul, I really appreciate your time now, and I really enjoyed the chat and just to get a bit of an insight into your own story and over the decades of reporting you've done. And I appreciate you coming on tonight.
And Ian, it's been a pleasure talking to you, my friend. I know I've been meaning to come and do this for you for quite some time. Probably timing is best, but you're a young man that I greatly admire as well. You're a courageous young man, and God bless you. And keep going the fight, my friend. You're an inspiration to everybody, and you make fellas like me feel inadequate.
Thanks a million, Paul.
You're very welcome, Ian.
Now, unfortunately, that's always time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I really appreciate you tuning in as always. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Paul and found it beneficial. He's an interesting man, and I'm delighted to get him on to talk to him about the books that he's wrote and I suppose the different stories that he has covered over the years. If you have any suggestions, questions, or requests before next week's show, you can get in contact with me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or you can send me an email to my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. I hope we're all having a great week so far. Stay tuned in here to Radio Kerry because Brian Priestley is up next with That's Jazz. I'll be back at the same time next week from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
You're listening to Standout with Enoconnell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.